Right, okay. So, good evening. We are now looking at the fourth day of creation. So, if we can turn over... No, it's on the first page, at the very bottom of the page. There, the fourth day. Let's see what it says. Vayom Elokim, and God said, Yihi Mo'orot V'Rakia HaShamayim, let there be luminaries in the firmament of heaven, Lahavdil Bein Hayom Ubein HaLayla, to distinguish between the day and the night, V'Hayu L'Otot, and they will be for signs, U'L'Mo'adim, and for special seasons, for special times, U'L'Yamim, and for days, V'Shanim, and for years, V'Hayu L'Mo'ot, and they will be luminaries, B'Rakia HaShamayim, in the firmament of heaven, L'Ha'ir Al Ha'aretz, in order to shine on the earth, Vayihi Chein, and it was so. And then it tells us, Vayas Elokim et Shnei Hamo'orot Hagdolim, and God made the two great luminaries, et Hamo'or Hagadol Memshelet Hayom, the great luminary for the ruling of the day, Ve'et hama'or hakaton, and the smaller luminary, the small luminary, lememshelet halayla, to rule over the night, ve'et hakochavim, and the stars. Va'yiten otam Elokim, and God put them, b'rakia hashamayim, in the firmament of heaven, la'ha'ir al ha'aretz, to shine on the earth, ולמשול ביום ובלילה, and to rule over the day and the night, ולהבדיל, and to separate, בין האור ובין החושך, between light and darkness. וירא אלוקים כי טוב, and God saw that it was good. ויהי ערב ויהי בוקר, and it was evening, and it was morning, Yom Ravi'i, the fourth day. So there we have the fourth day of creation, which is completely devoted to the creation of these luminaries, of the sun and the moon and the stars are also mentioned. And that's a very, very powerful focus. Now, once every 28 years, there is the anniversary of the creation of the sun. And the reason why it's once every 28 years is because in the Jewish calendar there are different cycles. On the one hand, there's obviously a cycle of a year, but there's a more complicated cycle, and it actually only goes back to its original position once every 28 years. And at that point, the sun is considered to have tremendous power, sort of spiritual power, because that is the moment of creation of the sun being reenacted. Now, the last time that this happened was in 1981. In other words, when this happened, because when this happened, there is a special blessing to be said. And the Jewish community often makes a great fuss out of this event, and people gather together and they say this blessing. It's called Birchat HaChama, the blessing on the sun. And it happened in 1981, and 28 years from 1981 is?
Very soon, next year.
Next year, yes, 2009. And
what month? When is it actually?
Well, it is always on a Wednesday, the fourth day of creation, because that's the day that the sun was created. And in fact, it is going to be on Erev Pesach next year.
Oh, nice.
So just to add to all the excitement, there will be the blessing on the sun on the eve of Pesach on that Wednesday. So I assume, let's just check this. That's Wednesday night will be Pesach. I'm just checking in this Luach. And here we are. Nisan. Yes, that's right. It's even got it as a little symbol in this diary. You see a little sun.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, just in this computer diary. It's got a little sun to show that it's the blessing of the sun.
When is it?
So that's going to be the 8th of April, Wednesday the 8th of April. You see the little sun?
Yeah.
That's, and that night is the night of Pesach. That will be the first Seder night.
Oh, wow.
On that Wednesday night.
So it's actually on the same day as Erev Pesach.
Yes,
oh,
on the same day as Erev Pesach.
Oh, how lovely. So it's on the night of the 8th of April. Okay.
Yeah, but the we do the Birchat HaChama in the morning.
In the morning.
On so the 8th be, in the morning.
Yeah, yeah, it'll be around the time of burning the Chametz.
Okay.
So at the same time, we will have the blessing on the sun. So it'll be a beautiful event. And that quality of the sun and the moon and the stars, which are really an amazing aspect of our consciousness, the fact that there is this phenomenon. I mean, we could have lived on a planet, we could imagine, where it's just always cloudy and there's just, you know, a kind of a light which filters through the clouds, but you never actually see the sun or a moon or stars. But in fact, there is this very spiritual quality of having the sun, moon and stars. And let's try to explore a number of images about these now. The first one is that, let's just take it in order,
there's so much.
The idea that the luminary is in the firmament, he says in the firmament of heaven, it says in the first verse about this, to separate between day and night, and to be for signs and for seasons. Moed, Moadim. Moadim, Moed actually means a festival. So, Moadim Nesimcha, we say, like it's a way of saying good Yom Tov in Hebrew. And the section of the Talmud which concerns Shabbat and festivals is called Moed. So, let's take it, first of all, there's day and night. It's an amazing thing that there is day, there are day and night, and the transition from day to night and from night to day. And the way in which Jewish consciousness is aware of that and follows that. The prayers, the Ma'ariv prayer in the evening, following the idea of sunset and nightfall, and then in the morning, Shacharit, the morning prayer. And the fact that these changes are taking place this is a deeply spiritual change which is taking place at the very essence of existence. For us, we experience it as a day and a night. But in fact, this is something very, very wonderful and very remarkable. It is said in the Talmud, in Menachot, Tractate Menachot, that when Moshe was on Mount Sinai, and he was there, I think it's there, Menachot, could be somewhere else, and he was there being taught the Torah by God, he was there for 40 days and nights. And in a sense, he was beyond time. He was completely beyond time. He didn't eat. He didn't sleep. But the difference between day and night had to do with what kind of Torah he was studying. Because when he was studying the written Torah, that was day. And when he was studying the oral Torah, that was night. So these are two dimensions of Torah, which are like, in a sense, the male and the female, the day and the night, and the way they link together. It's, so there is the first point of the sun expressing, ruling, it uses the word in Shul, the sun ruling the day, and then the moon ruling the night. Now, we'll come back in a moment to this verse, but let's just go ahead to another verse, which is verse 16. It says, God made the two great luminaries, the large luminary for ruling over the day, and the small luminary for ruling over the night. Now, how can it say in one verse that they are two great luminaries, and then it says that one is large and one is small? Go on, you tell me.
No, I don't know.
No? You're nodding wisely.
No, I'm just thinking, but I don't know.
So. Any suggestions?
Because they're both important, aren't they? We need to.
They're certainly both important.
Great, not in the, you know, I read great not in terms of size, but in terms of they need each other, significant. They both have equal significance.
The moon is more akin to the to a woman, to the female in creation, isn't she? She's more connected to the moon.
That's where you get the word lunatics from.
I was expecting something like that. The question is, would do does the sun is more?
It's a good one there.
The question was why they called the two, why they're both great.
Right.
One is bigger, one is smaller.
Yes.
But it's nothing to do with the size, it's to do with the significance.
Well, of
the
right.
Well, that's one answer.
But they're opposites as well.
They're equally significant.
Yeah, like men and women, they're equally significant. That's why I brought the woman, that was the idea.
With different characteristics here. But they're opposites.
They need each other.
Night and day.
They're like contrast.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, let's come away from the male and female concept for a moment.
It's like conscious and unconscious, you could see in that aspect as well, isn't it?
You see, for example, the sages of the Baalei HaTosafot, they say, like you say, they were both great, and but despite this, one was actually larger than the other. So they're both great. Now, Rashi gives a very interesting midrash. He quotes from the midrash a story. And that story has a profound Kabbalistic meaning. The story is like this. Rashi puts it very briefly. The two great luminaries. They were created equal, says Rashi. And then the moon was reduced. because it argued. It said it's impossible for two kings to have one crown. I suggest, you know, coming away from the male-female thing for the moment, we're looking at it here in terms of Sfirot, actually. The moon says it's impossible for two kings to have one crown, and as a result, the Midrash says, God said to the moon, Lechi mi'ati et atzmech, go and make yourself smaller. And because the moon was made smaller, she got the stars as a recompense. So together with the moon come the stars, and that is the sort of recompense for the moon. Now that is the Midrash. The Midrash expresses in a story form, you could tell a 5-year-old child this story. And it would be perfectly understandable, yes, that it's the sun and the moon. Obviously, everything in existence has a kind of animist life force, so everything is able to communicate and to argue, as we find throughout Torah teachings, the idea of the living quality of the objects around us. So on Shabbat, for example, when you have the two challah loaves on the table, and you put a cloth over them, and then we make kiddush on wine. And one of the explanations for the cloth, not the only explanation, but one of the explanations, is because normally we make the first blessing on the bread. Whenever we eat a meal, the first blessing we make is on the bread. On Shabbat, instead of making the blessing on bread, we start off making a blessing on wine. So just so that the two loaves of bread, the two chalot, should not get upset at this indignity, we cover them with a cloth, and then we make the blessing on the wine, and then we come to the bread. And my daughter used to say, so what is the IQ of a challah? Can't it work out that there is a half a glass of wine? But nonetheless, there's this sense of sensitivity about something, about everything, that everything has feelings in a way. And so here we have with the sun and the moon, that originally they were both very bright. And then comes the argument, some kind of argument. It's impossible for two kings to have one crown. There's some kind of conflict going on in existence. Say, interesting. God creates aspects of the universe, including the sun and the moon, and then they start arguing with him. There you are, seeing a constant theme of complaint, argument. And they start arguing, and as a result, the moon gets made smaller.
Probably because the moon started the argument.
Well, in simple terms, that's the way it's understood. Yeah, I mean, in the simple way of communicating that, you know, is it fair if you were teaching this to a class of 5-year-olds? One of the things about Torah is that it's got meaning for everyone. It's got meaning for the 5-year-old, it's got meaning for the 15-year-old, the 50-year-old, and the person 120 years old as well. It's got meaning all the time, just different levels of meaning, different aspects of meaning. But all the time one... See, Michael, that's the point about aging. That as one gets older, with more years, with the help of God, there comes more wisdom, and one is able to study more. And maybe certain aspects of life, one spends less time. But the wealth of the teachings of the Torah is always accessible, and in fact more and more and more. The Lubavitcher Rebbe very much recommended that there should be study sessions organized for senior citizens. And he called this the Tiferet Levi Yitzhaki, on the name of his father. And so there, around the world there are study sessions organized for elderly people, which you will reach in quite a number of years. With the help of God, with good health. But the idea that one can always learn more and more, and it's always, it's another idea, and one can take the same concepts and explore them again, and you have all these different commentaries, and so last year you looked at this commentary, and now you look at this commentary, and there's always something else, to find. It's fascinating, and it's infinite. There's no limit. Now, here we come to what we're touching on here is really the deep imbalance that there is in existence, which gives existence its uniquely poignant quality. And the Kabbalistic term, the simple Kabbalistic term for this imbalance is Galut Hashchina, the exile of the divine presence. Now, the exile of the divine presence, which is the tenth sphira, we have beginning with, sometimes one might begin with Keter, the crown, and sometimes one begins with Chochmah, wisdom, understanding, knowledge. When you count knowledge, then you don't count Keter, you see. So wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, and then kindness, severity, mercy, or Tiferet, and then victory, submission, dedication, and then Malchut, the Shechina. That's the tenth Sphira, kingship, the feminine, and the Shechina, the divine presence. And the idea that in some way the Shechina, the divine presence, is in exile. And the exile is our physical world. Because our physical world conceals the divine. And because it conceals the divine, people act in a way which might ignore the divine, and people may act in a way which betray the divine. And that being something that people do, people are given an enormous fulcrum of responsibility in the system of creation. Since people are doing the wrong thing, existence as a whole does the wrong thing. And there is illness and earthquakes and tsunami and this and that and the other. There is a painful, very, very painful aspect of existence. Instead of it being the radiant wholesomeness of the Garden of Eden, in which there is nothing negative in any way, everything is positive, and godliness is revealed, that even though it's a physical world, in some sense the presence of God is revealed and is there. So the idea of the Miut Halavana, that's the way it's referred to just as an incident, the decreasing of the moon, is in essence the whole story of existence and of the Torah. Because the Torah is going to play that story out in much broader terms with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and the snake. But this is a theme which we see again and again. Now, at the beginning of these study sessions, we talked about the idea of the Shvirat HaKelim, the breaking of the vessels, which is the very initial stage of process which is going to lead to a world where godliness is hidden. Because the breaking of the vessels leads to the klipot, which are, as it were, the broken vessels, and those broken vessels in some sense conceal the divine radiance within them, and so therefore we have a world where there is energy, which in fact comes from this divine radiance, but it's not seen as divine. It's an energy which is seen in materialistic terms or in other terms, and there are drives and passions and physical and other kinds of force, but it is something which does not have a divine flavor to, for most or many people's consciousness. Of course, it could have. And the goal is that it will have, that it should have, and that we should learn the divine image and the divine reality. We should learn to recognize that within every aspect of existence and be able to communicate that to others. And then, in some sense, we are rescuing, we are finding the divine presence which is hidden in existence. So there is a story about the Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, who incidentally, his birthday was the 18th of Elul in the year 1698. And if you go back to 1698, you find that the 18th of Elul was a Wednesday. So the Baal Shem Tov was born on a Wednesday. So there's something very special about this the fact of Wednesday. And so the Baal Shem Tov once saw a child, a little boy, crying. And he said, "Why are you crying?" He said, "Because we were playing hide and seek. And it was my turn to hide, and I hid. And my friends, instead of coming to look for me, they went to play by themselves." So that's obviously very upsetting for the little boy. And the Baal Shem Tov said, "That's exactly the plight that God is in. God hides in existence, and we're supposed to look for him, and we don't. We go off and play by ourselves."
Amazing story. How lovely.
So that is the hiding, the galut hashchinah, the concealment of the divine presence within the world, hidden away because of this concept of lechi miyati et etzmeich, go and make yourself small. Now, what exactly was the argument which led to this galut of the shchinah? It's not an argument in the ordinary sense of the word. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov told a story. He, at a certain point late in his life, he began telling stories in order to communicate spiritual ideas. And he told the story, the famous story of the lost princess. And the story begins with a king who had six sons and one daughter. You could say, which reminds you of the seven Sfirot. Mm-hmm. But so, and the king loved this daughter very dearly. And then one day he got angry with her. And he said something very negative to her. And she went away to her room. And then she didn't come down for supper, and she didn't come down for breakfast, and they went to the room, and they looked for her, and she was gone, and they looked all over the palace, and they looked all over the palace grounds, and the rest of the story is about a centuries-long or millennia-long search for the lost princess, and we are in, like, it's as if we are the ones who are looking for the lost princess, and the princess is the divine presence, Shina, and the Shekhinah, and we are looking for her in daily life and in the spirituality of daily life as taught by the Torah. There's an image in the story where the princess suddenly appears, although she's lost, but there's a moment where she comes into the picture and she's weeping because the person who was supposed to find her has fallen asleep. Because he did something wrong, he drank some wine. This is a hint to the whole idea of Noah, Noah, who had the chance to make a beautiful world, and he messed it all up by getting drunk. And so she takes off her kerchief and she writes on it in tears, and that's like an image for the Torah, and she leaves that so that when this person, who is the vizier, who is trying to find, when he wakes up, he finds that. She leaves a message for him. So that's the Torah, which is communicating to us the divine presence, where to find the divine presence. And in the mitzvot of the Torah, there is the secret, as it were. The fact that by living a Jewish life and by keeping kashrut and Shabbat and the other aspects of Jewish life, that and for the non-Jew, the 613, the seven Noahide laws, so in that way the whole of existence comes together and is able to recognize the divine and there find the divine within existence. But that is, initially, that is the story of the sun and the moon and the greater luminary and the lesser luminary. Now let's go back to the earlier verse, verse 14, where we began off. God said, let there be luminaries in the firmament of heaven to distinguish between the day and the night, and they will be for signs and for seasons. Because it is the movement of the sun and the moon together which creates the days, and then we have the process of the sun, 7 days, we finally come to Shabbat, the seventh day, and then we have a system of months. So there are days and weeks which are governed by the sun. And at the same time, in the Jewish calendar, there are months which are governed by the moon. Because the beginning of the Jewish month is when the moon just begins, the new moon, Rosh Chodesh. And then by the time we get to the 15th of the Jewish month, the moon is full. The moon is always a full round moon at the 15th of the month, like the first night of Pesach, the first night of Sukkot.
Yes.
These festivals where the moon is full and it's the 15th of the month. And then the moon gradually wanes, and that is the second part of the month. Now, the festivals, the system of festivals, is a combination of the sun. The sun has two effects. On the one hand, the sun gives there are the days and the weeks, and so on. But also the sun gives rise to the seasons.
Yeah.
See, there's seasons. Because at one season of the year, the sun is shining more strongly, summer, and then later there is autumn, and then winter, and then again there is spring, and then again there is summer. So even though there are 12 lunar months in the Jewish year, and let's say Nisan, which is the month when Pesach is supposed to be the first month, that first month also has to be in the spring. Now, the Muslims, they have a system based on lunar months, but it's purely according to the lunar months. So therefore Ramadan, which is an important Islamic festival or period, month of Ramadan, is sometimes in the summer, sometimes in the autumn, sometimes in the winter. It revolves around the season. Whereas for the Jewish people, we have both a lunar system and we have to adjust that to the solar system. And it's interesting that for the Christians, the solar system is the whole way in which the year is organized, whether it's the Gregorian calendar or the Julian calendar, but there is the concept of the solar structure of the seasons and the year and the dates, the month and the dates. And Judaism somehow balances both.
Mm.
Balancing both qualities. And in order to ensure that they do balance, every so often there is an extra month in the Jewish year. So instead of there being just 12 months, there's an extra month added, and it's added at the end of the year, just before Nisan. So we have Adar, the first Adar, or it's at that point, more or less. So we have the first Adar, and then the second Adar. And so, as it were, the 11th month, there's the 11th and then the 12th month, and then finally we have the last month of the year, which is Purim, where we have Purim, and then a month after Purim comes Pesach. So it's
every 4 years, isn't it?
It's not a simple regular system. Could be 3 year gap or 4 year gap, but it's over a 28 year cycle. It fits. There's a 28-year pattern. So that is the way in which the sun and moon dimensions of existence are being balanced out. Now, so we are talking then about a process where the moon, which in this instance is the image of the Jewish people, Yisrael, Domim Lelvana, the Jewish people are compared to Nimshadim Lelvana, they're compared to the moon. And the moon, and that's the concept of exile and redemption. So in general, the idea of the Miut HaLevana, the minimizing of the moon, which is an upsetting thing, and the Jews are in exile, and the temple is in ruins, and they're in different countries around the world, and even in Israel, they're not free, there are problems. That is the that's one aspect of this exile, and the of this comparison to the moon, and also the fact that in the course of a month the moon flourishes and it gets bigger and it gets bigger, and then again it gets smaller and it gets smaller. So it's as if there's a cycle of redemption and exile, a cycle of flourishing, of everything going well, and then unfortunately so often it becomes problematic again. And so it's this sense of cycle which is there, with anxieties as well. There are some customs that if one is planning the date of a marriage, one tries not to have it in the second part of the month when the moon is getting smaller, unless it's a very special month which is illuminated in some other way, that there is something else which is special about the month. So there is this sense that the waning moon expresses something which is problematic, and there are problematics in existence. And that's a part of life, that life is not just simply a perfect picture. There are images of perfection, and at the same time there are images of imperfection, and of getting better, and of achieving something, and of falling down again, and then climbing higher, and then going further. Now this cosmic image of the sun and the moon, relating also to the sort of spiritual substructure of existence, where you have different forces, spiritual forces, which are giving existence to the world and which promote the atmosphere of the world, and the fact that the Shekhinah, that the divine presence, is in exile, gives the world its heart-rending quality. That's the painful quality about existence and so many aspects of existence, whether it's human evil, sometimes unfortunately, or also unfortunately human suffering. The suffering that is there in existence. And there's almost a sense that all existence is suffering. the very energy which is there hidden in a mountain is in a sense in a state of tension because it's not resolved. There one has a force of divine energy which in a sense is in exile and is not able to express itself completely, because if it did express itself completely, then everyone looking at the mountain or at the flower or at the leaf or at the river, they would feel godliness is close to me, and as a result I'm going to live my life in a better way. And there would be a sense of revelation, in which case the world would be the Garden of Eden with an expression of the divine at every step. Now, that cosmic image also moves in to create the consciousness of each person. Because the sun and the moon are within us as well. Each of us has the power of radiance of the sun. Each of us is blessed by God that at certain aspects of our life, certain situations, or in general aspects of our life, we are able to give radiance, hashba'ah, influence, flow, some kind of positive emanation, which comes from every human being just by virtue of being a human being. The person has that quality, which may be hidden in many situations, and the challenge of the good educator or the good counselor is to be able to bring out that quality of the good emanation which flows and can flow from every person. At the same time, we all, that is the sun aspect of all of us. But at the same time, there is the moon aspect. Now, the difference between the sun and the moon, as everyone learns in geography or astronomy, in very simple terms, is that the sun gives radiance and the moon receives it. The moon doesn't shine with
its
own light.
But reflects the radiance of the sun.
That's right.
So that is also a good thing.
Absolutely. And so that is a quality we have as well within us, the ability to receive radiance from someone else and then reflect it with our own quality. Because the moon shines with a different kind of light to the sunlight. So the sun, the light is actually coming from the sun and it's shining onto the moon. And so we can see it. But the quality of the moonlight is quite different to the sunlight. But in the same way, this is put into human terms, each of us enjoys and can get radiance from others and from our chain of teachers, going back down through the ages, the Torah teachers through the ages, which are bringing us this radiance of light, the light of Torah. Torah is very often compared to light, and I want to come on to that whole imagery around light in a moment. But there is this flow of the radiance of light into each of us, and each one of us has to be the mekabel, the one who accepts that radiance as well. Now, and then when we accept it and we reflect it back, we in turn become a moon or even a sun ourselves. So there's this, both parts of the process. There's the shining and there's the receiving, and then there is making what we received into our own, and then there's the reflecting, and even, and then a further dimension where we're actually giving a radiance. Each of us. And this is the process of life. This is the process.
It's a beautiful image as well, isn't it? Because as a moon, the light, I'm a moon now. The light is not mine, but I receive it and reflect it. Isn't it that image that is not mine in an ego sense of it?
Absolutely.
But I just receive it and I shine back.
Absolutely. I mean, when we look at the ethics of the fathers, Moshe received the Torah from Mount Sinai. Umasarali Yeshua, and he transmitted it to Joshua. So Moshe is receiving the Torah, and then he's giving it to Joshua. Joshua receives the Torah, and then he gives it to the elders. Then the elders, they transmit it to the prophets, and so on down through the generations. We're all in this chain where we are each one of us receiving like the moon and then transmitting like the sun. And each one of us, we're giving to the next generation and to those around us. So that's all the time, this very, very special process. Now, in this, the imagery of light, you see, at the very beginning of creation, we had Yehi Or, let there be light. And what was fascinating about that on the first day of creation is that that was a light which didn't have a source. It didn't have a sun or a moon which was shining the light. It was just simply light, and it was like an essential light, a light which is from the very, very origin of all being, that there is a spiritual radiance which is hidden there. And it's as if that is real light. But then we come to this more tangible, understandable light, that there is the sun which is emitting a tremendously powerful radiant, or anything, a candle in someone's house, or an electric light, or a log fire, whatever it might be. Now, light then becomes a metaphor. And throughout Jewish thought, and particularly in Kabbalistic thought, the metaphor of light is something extremely significant. There is the structure of the Sefirot are conceived as vessels within which is light. And the vessels have different qualities, so one we could call kindness and another severity. But then there is the radiance which is flowing through the Sefirot. So it's as if there is a radiance coming from the infinite which is flowing through the Sefirot, and each Sefirot has its own quality, as if it's its own color. And there is a discussion by the Kabbalists about whether the radiance in the Sefirah, kindness, chesed, is the same radiance as that which is in the Sefirah, gvura, severity, or if it's just the vessel which makes the difference, and really it's the same radiance of the name Yudke Vavke, or maybe it's something different. So there is this sense of a flow which is flowing through, And this spiritual energy described as light. And of course, light itself is a tangible form of energy. Light is a form of energy. So then we have the idea of the light within the Torah. That within the words of the Torah, and if we look just at the page, we've got the Hebrew letters on the page. Now you can imagine, just looking at them for a moment, that the white spaces between the letters is in fact a spiritual radiance. And the black letters are another dimension of radiance, which is called by Nachmanides, Ramban, in his introduction to the Torah, quoting the Midrash, Eish Shechora, black fire, al gabe Eish Levana, on white fire. So there we have those two kinds of radiance which are somehow there. There's even a word used in the Zohar and in the Lurianic Kabbalah, Botzina de Kadonita. It's a Aramaic word. Botzina means a candle of darkness. So the candle shines a kind of dark radiance, and that is a more elevated kind of radiance. There's the bright white radiance, as it were, and then beyond that is a darker dimension, which is beyond in some way. So this is the idea of the fourth day of creation as the day on which the sun and the moon and the stars are created. We haven't spoken at all about the stars and the whole idea of the stars and the constellations of stars, the 12 mazalot, which are the constellations, and the constellations are spoken of in Jewish thought as they are by astrologers or astronomers in certain ways. There are certain connections, but I want to focus on another aspect of this: the fact that it's the fourth day of creation. Now, if we go back to the simple quality of numbers, we recently had the festival of Shavuot, celebrating the giving of the Torah. And the Talmud in Tractate Shabbat discusses this and speaks about the way that everything on Shavuot had something to do with the number three. Why the number three? Well, first of all, the month when the Torah was given. Nisan was the first month when they came out of Egypt, then there was Iyar, and then Sivan. So Sivan is the third month. Now, in the account of the giving of the Torah, Moshe says to the people, you should be ready on the third day. Mm-hmm. In terms of the date of Sivan, it was the sixth of Sivan, but a few days before that, he said to them, be ready on the third day. So the idea of 3 days of preparation for the giving of the Torah. In essence, what is the Torah? Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. The Torah, the five books of Moses, and the prophets, and the hagiography, the writings, like Psalms and so on. So that's a triple Torah. Mm-hmm. Who receives the Torah? The Jewish people, who are divided into Kohanim, mm-hmm. Levi'im, and Yisrael. So we have a tripart people, a people mm-hmm. who are three. And then, who gives the Torah to the Jewish people? Moshe. Now, what position is Moshe in his family? Who are his siblings?
Oh, he's the third.
Yes.
He's the third, yeah.
He's the third child.
Aaron and Miriam.
Aaron and Miriam come before him. And then we have Moshe. So all of this is mentioned by the Talmud. So each of those different dimensions expresses the number three. Now, the Talmud doesn't give any further explanation. It just comments on the way in which there's the number three in every aspect of the giving of the Torah. The Lubavitcher Rebbe discusses why, what is so significant about the number three. And he presents it like this. Number one means God. Mm. There's only God. Nothing apart from God. Two means that on the one hand there is God, and on the other hand there's the universe. There's existence. There's life. So there is godliness, and here is existence. The Torah is number three, which comes to bond existence and godliness together so that they become genuinely one and the godliness within existence is expressed. Now that's as regards the significance of the number three in relation to the giving of the Torah. However, on a certain occasion, which was Rosh Chodesh Tammuz, which is the fourth month, so on the new moon of Tammuz, the Rebbe gave a talk about the number four. There is this process, one, two, three, godliness, existence, and Torah, and the Torah is coming to us. Mm-hmm. We are the number four. We are the ones who are receiving the Torah, like the moon. that the moon, if we put it back into the story, the sun and the moon, there's the radiance which is coming, and there is the moon receiving the radiance, and then it has to grow through that radiance, and it has to express it to others, and it has to express it in the world, and it has to make the world into the full expression of Godhead. So there we have number four, which is the day of the fourth day of the week, when the sun and the moon and the stars were created. The Rebbe did not make that connection as far as I know, so it's something I'm suggesting. He spoke about the number four in the context of the fourth month, but I'm putting it together with a little bit of poetic license, if you like, into this account of what one has to know when one is using poetic license. Into this account of the creation of the sun and the moon on the fourth day. And so we have that flow coming into us, into existence, which is this level of spirituality from godliness. And I'm going to conclude with a quote from a letter of the Baal Shem Tov, born, as I mentioned, on a Wednesday, the 18th of Elul, which is later in the summer. When he was born, it was a Wednesday. It's not always a Wednesday. And he said as follows, that you should know in every word of Torah study or prayer, looking at these blank Hebrew words on the page, that in every letter there are worlds, olamot, that means spiritual worlds, and neshamot, and souls, and elokut, and godliness. And that's in each letter. And then the letters join together, and they become a word. And that gives extra energy, the fact of the letters being bonded and becoming not just separate letters, but a word with its own meaning. And there, this flow, it's a flow, it's not static. This flow of worlds and souls and godliness is flowing towards the One, towards the essence of all being. And we who are studying it should try to join with that flow. Let our own soul, let our own being be part of that. And I would suggest that the way we let our being be part of it is by, in practical terms, trying to implement some aspect of the teachings of the Torah. That when we do something of the teachings of the Torah, putting a few pennies in a charity box, let's say, which is a simple general mitzvah, I would advise everyone in their artistic studio or next to their computer, wherever, to have a charity box and to put in a few pennies every so often, because every day, because at that moment we are expressing this flow of radiance. We've become like the moon absorbing the radiance from the sun and then radiating it onwards, which is exactly the process. In fact, charity is a good example of that, because we receive and then we give an exact thing.
Amen.
Amen.
Beautiful, thank you. I've got a question about the stars, but it can be off the record.
So the Baal Shem Tov said that each letter is...
In every letter there are worlds.
In every letter,